This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
But journalists in Cameroon say they are victims of increasing oppression. They say the government clamps down on media that hold contrary opinions to state actions.
That was Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting on the suspension of some media outlets in Cameroon. Details coming up also. Pope Francis is safely out of surgery, while Senegal is urging to investigate violence against protests. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Sudan's permanent representative to the United Nations, Al-Harith Idris, called on Saudi Arabia and the United States to put pressure on the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, to abide by the outcome of indirect negotiations with the army in Jeddah. On Tuesday, Idris spoke with Al Hura Arabic TV channel, which is funded by VOA's parent agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media. He said the army has reservations about continuing talks if the RSF does not abide by any ceasefire. On Tuesday, the army commander and head of Sudan's Sovereign Council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, spoke by phone with Saudi Foreign Minister Faisal bin Farhan. Idris says Saudi Arabia and the United States are partners in brokering talks. He says the Saudi kingdom is a party to working towards a ceasefire through coordination in which all parties are represented, and Al-Burhan affirmed his confidence in the Jeddah platform leading to sustainable peace. Idris's statements comes as news reports indicate the two warring parties had resumed indirect talks aimed at a ceasefire in Jeddah. 2 days ago, the Rapid Support Forces said its commander, Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, also had spoken with the Saudi foreign minister and reaffirmed RSF support for the Jeddah platform. Millions of Sudanese are suffering shortages, suffering food, water, power and medicine because of the conflict. Nearly 2,000 have been killed and more than a million have been displaced. Idris said there are efforts to help ease the suffering. Idris says they are in contact with the Office for Relief Coordination, OSHA, which allocated $18 million 3 weeks ago and then launched a campaign to raise $2 billion. Earlier ceasefires brokered in Jeddah collapsed and further negotiations broke down last week. There have been reports this week of continued fighting, particularly in the capital, Khartoum. Today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Saudi Foreign Minister bin Farhan said they would continue their close cooperation on talks to end the conflict. Journalists in Cameroon say the government's indefinite shutdown of a radio station and suspension of four reporters is a sign of a growing crackdown on the country's news media. The government says it is trying to stop the spread of hate speech, while journalists say officials want to retaliate against criticism of President Paul Biya. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Mesdames, Messieurs, bonjour et merci de nous retrouver sur Vision 4 Télévision pour cette émission Club
des. This is the voice of Bruno Bijang, host of the popular program on Vision 4 TV called Club d'Elite. In the program, Bijang says he will continue exercising his profession to the best of his ability without fear. However, Cameroon's National Communication Council, an organ created by the government to regulate the media, imposed a one-month suspension on Bijang for hosting guests who the government says used hateful language on his program. The NCC says Bijang was warned several times, but he continued inviting such guests on the program. The council this week also imposed suspensions on a radio station and three other media practitioners for broadcasting offensive or hateful content. NCC President Joe Chebonken Kalabubse says these journalists and media outlets propagated hate speech and xenophobic language.
We have noticed that we can nip the problem in the bud by helping journalists to be more professional. We want to encourage journalists to be as professional as possible. We would not hesitate to sanction them if they falter.
Kalabubse said he has informed Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, Paul Atanganji, to make sure that journalists who do not respect the order are punished and media organs that continue to broadcast are permanently closed. Nji says he has instructed the police and local government officials to force the journalists to respect the sanctions.
The media men should know that they have the moral obligation to comply by respecting these decisions taken for the common good. Because if we are in a state of law and we don't respect the laws of the republic, then we are walking towards a jungle, and Cameroon is not a jungle. We should use liberty of expression to construct and not to destroy. So I want to tell the media men that they have the obligation to comply. If they don't comply, we will accompany them to comply by force.
But journalists in Cameroon say they are victims of increasing oppression. They say the government clamps down on media that hold contrary opinions to state actions. The Cameroon Journalist Trade Union says the NCC is an organ set up by Biya to defend his interests and crack down on journalists who oppose his rule. The trade union says senior state functionaries and military officials who are accused of corrupt practices asked the NCC to suspend reporters, a charge the NCC denies. The government says hate speech propagated through media organs has become rampant since the disputed 2018 presidential election. In addition, some French-speaking host communities accuse English speakers displaced by the separatist conflict in the West of being separatist fighters or sympathizers. Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration says local media that do not stop guests in debate programs from asking communities to rise against one another will be punished. Journalists who anchor such programs will also be punished, the government says, though it has not outlined the nature of the punishment. Cameroon has more than 600 newspapers, about 200 radio stations, and 60 TV networks, yet producing independent and critical reporting is still very challenging, according to Reporters Without Borders. In its 2023 World Press Freedom Index, the organization said Cameroon is one of Africa's most dangerous countries for journalists since they operate in a hostile and precarious environment. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Human Rights Watch is calling on Senegalese authorities to conduct a full independent investigation into the crackdown last week on protests in which 16 deaths were reported and dozens of demonstrators were arrested. The protests broke out in Dakar and other cities after a criminal court sentenced main opposition leader Ousmane Sonko to 2 years in prison for corrupting youth. Karin Kanzi Nanatulia, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch Africa Division, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that her organization interviewed 19 people, including 3 protesters and 3 civil society activists.
The witnesses we spoke to said that demonstrators took on the streets in Dakar, built barricades, blocked main roads, burned tires, destroyed, looted public and private property, threw stones at the police, who responded with tear gas. One of them said that he couldn't even breathe. There was so much tear gas grenades. On June 1st, the Interior Minister announced restrictions on social media to stop the dissemination of hate and subversive messages. On June 4th, the government extended the outage to mobile internet access. So far, according to lawyers and the opposition, from May 30th to June 2nd, security forces arrested at least 250 people. The government announced 500 people, including women and children, and mostly PASTEF members and supporters, but also civil society activists, and beat some of them. We are calling on the Senegalese authorities to immediately ensure first and foremost an independent and credible investigation into the violence during the protest that happened in Dakar and across the country since May 31st.
Has Macky Sall's government responded to your request for a full investigation?
Not yet. But we do know, and that's public information, that the UN Secretary General's representative, the AU chairperson, the regional bloc ECOWAS have issued statements calling on restraints, and Moussa Faki actually called on the government, and we're also referencing African Union standards and mechanisms, such as the guidelines for the policing of assemblies by law enforcement officials in Africa, which provide that law enforcement officials may use force only in proportion to the seriousness of the offense, and that the use of lethal force is only permitted when strictly unavoidable to protect life.
What about that lethal force? Has Human Rights Watch been able to confirm whether or not the forces, government forces, used live ammunition on protesters?
We were not able to confirm that, although we received testimonies from different witnesses that at least one young man, a 24-year-old young man, was shot in the chest by security forces. So this is not a situation or crisis that's going to go away until some very serious measures are taken by the government.
That's Karine Anatulia, Deputy Director of the Africa Division of Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Washington. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The Vatican says Pope Francis is safely out of a three-hour surgery at Rome's Gemelli Hospital today for his second abdominal surgery in 2 years. The 86-year-old pontiff's medical team recently decided that surgery was required on his abdominal wall to repair a type of hernia that sometimes happens along previous surgical scars. The Pope entered the hospital earlier today but made no mention of the planned operation at his weekly audience at the Vatican on Wednesday morning, where he appeared in good spirits. The pontiff has had a number of health problems over the years. In 2021, the Pope had 33-centimeter section of his colon removed in an operation aimed at addressing a painful bowel condition called diverticulitis. He said earlier this year that the condition had returned. In March this year, he was treated in a hospital for bronchitis, and he has long suffered from back, hip, and knee pain. Around the world, many people are worried about Pope Francis. In South Sudan, many people there particularly are concerned because in February, he was the first pope to visit the country. For VOA, Manyang David Mayar asked people in Juba about his latest illness.
My name is Acolyte Peter Attilio. Because of the healing of Pope Francis, for me, Peter, I will pray for him, because he's our Father, Holiness Father, and secondly, because we are all trust in him, because he's our Pope. So I wanted for him to heal, to be okay like any people. Thank you.
My name is Elizabeth Joa Arcangelo. As I heard the message about the sickness of Pope, and also it reminds me when he comes here, because I saw him physically, and I know what he's thinking about South Sudan. But everything in the hands of God. So we leave it to God. We tell to God that may his healing hand reach to the Pope until he enters his operation, and the operation will be successfully in the name of God. And also I wish him quick recovery.
My name is William Okot from Juba, so I'm the Catholic Archdiocese of Juba. We are so sad to hear this issue, the health of Papa Francis. I think he's the first Pope who visited South Sudan. He risked his life to see this country where people are suffering, the rest are even fearing to come. but he came here to give us message of peace, and he left. So we are praying, may God help him, or may God give him a healing hands.
Those were the thoughts of people in Juba about Pope Francis's latest health problems. Judges at the UN War Crimes Court ruled that elderly Rwandan genocide suspect Felician Kabuga is unfit to stand trial, but said slimmed down legal proceedings in his case can continue. In a decision published in the Hague's court's website on Wednesday, the judges said the decision came after doctors found Kabuga suffered from dementia. Louis Mudge is Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. VOA's Douglas Mpuga reached him for a reaction in the court's decision.
When Felician Kabuga was arrested in 2020, when his trial started in 2022, victims of the genocide in Rwanda and us at Human Rights Watch were celebrating this. There's very, very credible evidence to support the allegations that he is one of the chief planners for planning, ordering, and carrying out the genocide in Rwanda. The fact that Kabuga has been deemed unfit to be convicted, frankly, is, I think, justice denied for the many, many victims of genocide in Rwanda. And I think it, in some ways, demonstrates that Felician Kabuga was able to escape justice right till the end. So I understand the judge has to make this ruling, and that is within his purview. But this is bitter news and disappointing news nonetheless.
Given the gravity of the alleged crimes against Mr. Kabuga, what do you think the victims now have to do?
Well, I'm not sure there's much they can do. Kabuga's case was always held within the residual mechanism of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. His case is unfolding in The Hague, in the Netherlands. And, you know, I think the hope, certainly of Human Rights Watch, and I think the hope of many victims, certainly the victims of the genocide who I've spoken to since he was arrested, was that in a free and fair and open trial, Kabuga would be made to explain for his role, his very important role that he is alleged to have committed. And now the fact that they're going to try some new accountability mechanism, they're going to try some new, you know, type of legal procedure, but one that does not have the possibility of a conviction, I think is deeply disappointing. Felician Kabuga, based on the crimes he is alleged to have committed and the evidence that has already been presented against him by groups like Human Rights Watch, he is someone who should very much face the possibility of spending the rest of his life, no matter how short it is, behind bars for the crimes he committed. And it is disappointing to think that that might not be the case.
Does your organization know what other remedy is there for the court, as they say they have some other mechanism?
They proposed a vague alternative legal procedure that will resemble a trial, but without the possibility of convictions. I have to tell you this, I've been working at Human Rights Watch for 13 years. It's the first time I've encountered this in my professional capacity, but maybe there's precedent. I don't know what the court has in mind. It's not been very much laid out, and the news only broke today. But when you take away the possibility of conviction, it really does begin to make you question, you know, what type of procedure are we talking about? Felician Kabuga, the crimes he's alleged to have committed are not something that would come out in a Truth and Reconciliation Commission sort of session. He is alleged to have supported Radio Milcolin, which was the radio station that organized the killing in 94, and he is alleged to have been one of the key purchasers of many of the machetes that were used by the Interahamwe to kill men, women, and children who were fleeing for their lives. I guess the only sort of solace is that Felician Kabuga lived his life in hiding. He will go down as someone who's remembered for the war crimes and crimes against humanity he's alleged to have committed. And he was captured. So he was not able to die without having been at least presented. And, you know, that is something. That's not nothing. The fact that he was captured, there was hard work that went into capturing him. And he was arrested. That at least is some solace.
Is there fear that many of those responsible
for the genocide in Rwanda are going to be too old to ever face justice?
I think it's legitimate fear. The genocide was almost 30 years ago, and time is moving on. Luckily, and in a very good way, Fulgence Kayishima, who was also an alleged mastermind of a particular massacre, so he's not on the level, in my opinion, of Felicien Kabuga, but nonetheless, he is regarded as someone who was a real driving force. He was arrested last week in South Africa. So there is hope that these individuals will continue to be arrested and that they'll continue to be held accountable for the crimes they've committed. But you raise a valid point. Time is moving on.
That's Louise Mudge, Central Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with Douglas Mpuga from New York. South Africa's Human Settlement Minister, Mamaloko Kubaye, is leading the country's delegation to the second UN Habitat Assembly underway in Nairobi, Kenya. The assembly focuses on building a sustainable urban future using inclusive and effective multilateralism. VOA's Ruben Chama spoke with Minister Kubaye on the sidelines of the assembly.
Firstly, on the global action plan of eradication of informal settlements and slum dwelling, we've championed that resolution, but we're also supportive of other resolutions. As we build cities, as we build communities, let's ensure that women are included. The issue of the new urban agenda, together with building resilient communities. For South Africa, we've had quite unprecedented disasters that as a sign of being affected by global warming and global climate change, and therefore building resilient cities and inclusive of communities where communities are displaced and how we place them remains one of the most important things. So when you look at the new urban agenda, you'll see that it talks about urbanization, where population will grow in terms of almost 70% that is moving to urban areas. And therefore, for cities to be ready to respond to that remains critical. And that's why these conversations happening here at UN Habitat Assembly are critical for us to champion that work, share experiences, but guide in terms of policy development across the globe.
And Minister, where do you see significant progress across the region? And also, what would you say are the pressing setbacks?
I think when we look at the SDG goal development attainment, you'd see that the sub-Saharan remains behind in terms of progress towards that. And part of the issue, we do need to pay attention to ensuring that we can develop goals. And that's why, as South Africa, for example, we championed the Global Action Plan as one of the mechanisms to accelerate progress towards ensuring that we can attain our SDG goals so that we are not left behind. The issues of resources, I always argue that when we talk about climate financing, majority of the time is focused on energy and a reduction of carbon emission. It forgets that impact of climate change displaces communities, and therefore there isn't resources that are allocated in resettling people. And that's quite of the issues that are important for us as global communities when we talk, so that we look at the financing model, because there are other communities that do not have anything. As communities are displaced, we've got to be able to support them in ensuring that even those are living within the level and standards that are acceptable. Issues of land availability and land tenure is critical in human settlements or even in terms of housing. The issue of basic services for the people to have the ability of water, electricity, and sanitation remains critical. And for us as a continent, those are some of the things that we've got to be able to champion.
That was South Africa's Human Settlements Minister Mamaloko Kubaye speaking with VOA's Ruben Chama from Nairobi. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.